Well, hello there. Jacob Burton here from StellarCulinary.com, and in this episode of Ask Chef Jacob podcast, I am joined in studio with Ben and Alex to discuss some industry issues. As is our nature of being potty-mouthed chefs when we're having a free-flowing discussion, more expletives than usual are used in this episode. So if you are easily offended by naughty language, you might want to turn this episode off right now. Thanks for listening. This is Ask Chef Jacob, episode 16. And here we go with another episode of Ask Chef Jacob. Found online at AskChefJacob.com. Pretty nifty, huh, Alex? You can just go to AskChefJacob.com and we'll drop you right into our audio index. Did you know that you can actually leave a voicemail message, too? You just click the record button and it pops up on your phone or your computer. It's actually pretty sick.
Amazing.
I did not know that.
Yeah, and no one uses it either. They just email me, which is fine. I guess they like hearing me read their emails.
It's a cool tool, though.
I think it's cool.
Well, I mean, who besides gamers and nerds like you actually have microphones?
No, everyone has them built into their computer and their iPhone.
Oh.
So you can, and the technology is really good, actually. So like, I've recorded stuff on my iPhone before, just like using like the recording app. And if you submit a question, it sounds better than that recording app that's native to the phone. Like, it's, their technology is really good. It's done through a company called SpeakPipe. And so I just embed like their recording button on my website, and then people hit record. And every computer nowadays has a microphone built into it. Or they
have laptops.
Laptops and iPhone.
Alex isn't a laptop person.
Whatever. Well, you have a smartphone. It works with your smartphone. iPad. You know, all that sort of stuff.
Neat.
I think it's cool. I mean, there's no need for you to be a dick about it, Alex, but I think it's cool. You know, but so the point is, you know, I have gotten some audio questions, but people just prefer to either ask them on the forum or write them in via email. And this one is from Sandra, and she's been remembering that it was back in episode 9 of Ask Chef Jacob, the dude who we gave a bunch of advice for becoming a professional chef.
Oh, yeah.
Stuff.
That guy.
Yeah, so we got some really good response from that episode. Like, it's our most popular one, and people really like it a lot.
Really?
Yeah. Nice.
Well, that was a lot of, like, you know, heartfelt knowledge, like, yeah, we put into that.
Yeah, no, we got in depth, and Sandra was one of them who liked it. And so she is a Colombian native and an Army veteran, and then it sounds like her husband is also an Army veteran, so or still active in the armed forces. So they move all around the world, and she's getting into cooking, and she's worked in a lot of kitchens. You know, she's taking classes, all that sort of stuff.
What? Oh. I need something to fiddle with.
We need to get you like a focus ball or something.
You should use a Rubik's cube.
Rubik's that would cube. Be awful.
Those are so loud.
So, Sandra, so her question is, having had the opportunity to experience the internal workings of restaurants from Colombia, Paris, Tel Aviv, Israel, Catania, Rome, France, Switzerland, Frankfurt, Berlin, Barbados, just name a few international ones, and in California, South, North Carolina, Queens, New York, the Florida Keys, Tennessee. In the U.S., it appears that some restaurant kitchens, and even more specifically chefs, make the choice for chaos. I mean that to say that not all kitchens are loud, rude, with people screaming and treating each other badly, overworked, disgruntled employees that hate what they do and who they work for. Now, there is a second part to this question, but I wanted to stop and discuss that for a moment.
And she was saying U.S. kitchens were like this or not like
yes,
this?
Yes.
Okay, they were like this. Okay.
As compared to where she's been elsewhere in the world.
I think it's an old culture thing. You know, I think 20 years ago in a kitchen, you had a lot lot more militaristic kind of environment, and that led to, you know, employees not being as happy. You know, there was a lot more hostility in the kitchen. When I first started working in kitchens, that was kind of generally the environment. But I think, you know, kitchens have come a long way. It's a different culture. You know, if you treat each other with respect, you get a lot more done rather than just being militaristic. That's just my observation, you know, in my career.
I think people understand the value of morale more these days.
Yeah.
I agree. I mean, I think there's a lot of, you know, things backloaded into that question based upon her observations. So it's like, you know, well, what kind of kitchens did you work at in the United States? And
and it's also just the nature of the work and the kinds of people that attract.
Yeah.
This
kind of working work in a stressful environment, you know.
But that's an important point. A lot of people, quite frankly, and it's changed now with the whole like celebrity chef thing, which is also why part of our culture, the kitchen culture, is changing. But a lot of people, quite frankly, they it sounds bad to say, but they end up in a kitchen because they run out of options. And that used to really be the...
That's me.
Me too.
Whereas me, I actually made the conscious decision to go to culinary school because I wanted to become a chef. You know, but you'll see it where, like, you know, convicts get out of jail and the only position they can get is a dishwasher. And then the chef's like, well, shit, I don't, you know, care that you're a convict. You have a hard work ethic and you wash dishes like an animal. So now I'm going to put you on, you know, in the garde manger, or, you know, move you on up. And so you have this really odd cross culture of people who end up in professional kitchens, and then you mix that together with there being heat and egos, tension,
just stress in general. Yeah,
I mean, you're gonna have certain things that reach a boiling point, and some kitchens are more disciplined than others. And I also find, too, it's easier to have a disciplined kitchen when people are proud of the product that they're putting out. You know, when you have a lot of frustrations rise to the surface when people are... Because whether you work in a shitty restaurant that serves shitty food or a great restaurant that serves awesome food, you're still breaking your balls every single day. You know what I mean? Like, it's not easy to work in a Turn and Burn that serves a disgusting hamburger. I mean, there's still the same... Not necessarily the... You're still putting in some really hard labor where you're scrubbing stoves and, you know, working in a hot kitchen that's 120 degrees, you know, feeling the crush of dinner service. So when you add all that stress up with the fact that you hate the product that you're putting out, that you're working so hard to just create this subpar product, then I think you see a lot of issues with morale, and that's when the infighting starts.
I agree with that. You know, if I'm doing 300 LTOs a day and putting out mediocre burgers, I'm not going to be as happy with my job as, let's say, here, where we can just be inventive and, you know, be proud of what we make and, you know, invent stuff for ourselves. And, you know, when the food goes out to the customer, we're proud of it, and it gives us a little better morale.
At the same time, though, I started at a chain pizza joint, for Christ's sake, and I took fucking pride in my work.
But you were also serving good food.
Yeah, Mountain Mike's good pizza.
I was making it.
Yeah, well, because you were making it. And that, you know, so, I mean, don't get it twisted. Just because I say, like, a chain Turn and Burn, that doesn't inherently mean that you're serving shitty food.
No, not at all.
You know, what I mean to say is everyone's been to a low-end restaurant that's busy, that's crushed, that serves bad food. And what my point is those cooks in the back of the kitchen that are serving that bad food, they're still breaking their back, working a really, really hard job.
Yeah.
That's very stressful and hard for most people to keep their cool under. So then you add the fact of, like, so at the end of the day, when your ass is righteously kicked and you've had a bunch of customer complaints and servers shitting on you because they're pissed off because they have to deal with all these customer complaints, you know, that breaks morale. And then that's when you start seeing all the nasty fights that can go down between kitchen staff and front of the house and...
Or like no call, no shows.
No call, no shows. Yeah, because it's like you're burnt out from the last 3 days. And he's like, what, I'm going to show up on a Saturday night to work a 14-hour shift just to get fucking yelled at and to serve shitty food? For what, $9 an hour?
Yeah.
No, thank you. You know, you can fuck off with that bullshit.
But yeah, when you're proud of the food, it makes morale way better.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
or food and service both.
I agree. And also too, you know, the whole cliche, maybe it isn't the right word, there seems to be this idea of chefs being the TV version of Gordon Ramsay.
Oh, God.
You know, just yelling and screaming constantly. And for me, like, a good chef was always like a mentor. You know, almost like a parent figure in the sense, like, there's discipline and structure, but he's not going to come home drunk and beat you for the sake of beating you. You know what I mean? Like, he's going to have discipline and have things, you know, in line. And if you step out of line, there's going to be some actions to get people back in line because there needs to be discipline in a kitchen. But for the most part, they want to see you grow. They want to see you mature. They want to mentor you into, you know, something better. And just like, you know, as a father, my daughter's success is important to me because it reflects me as a father and also makes me proud as a father. As a chef, my lineage is important to me too. I want to see guys leave my kitchen better than when they came and move into positions that working with me helped them achieve because, you know, they were able to learn new things and not only learn new things from me, but actually just grow as a person in the environment that's created. And I think that's really important and sometimes is overlooked. And a lot of times when you have those crazy chefs that are just nut jobs, they, quite frankly, they normally have some sort of substance problem. They're showing up drunk. They're showing up just blasted on coke or whatever. You know, those still do exist. But they've also, too, they've broken under the stress and they've lost control. When you start just screaming nonsense at your cooks, you've lost control. There's no other way around it. Because think of the reverse argument. If you were in control, if you had a solution, then you could easily fix the problem, right? I go to Ben, hey, Ben, you know, let's not do it like this because this is the result that we're getting. Let's instead do it like that, okay? Ben's like, cool, no problem. Ben, you fucking asshole, why the fuck did you fucking serve that fucking shit?
And then I'm going to be pissed off at you and I'm exactly. Probably going to do it half-assed the second time.
And notice that in my screaming at him, I'm just showing rage, right? I'm not showing a solution because I have no solution because I've lost control of the situation. And that's where that notion of the screaming chef comes from, because there are plenty of chefs out there who don't have enough solutions and have lost control of their kitchens.
But do you think the culture of chefs have changed within the last 20, 30 years?
Yes and no.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I sometimes still struggle a bit. I mean, not with you guys, but when we were doing a more regular dinner service before we switched over to the full Stella culinary model, and we were in the, you know, throes of fine dining, and we had a larger kitchen crew and, you know, a whole front of the house employees, and I had, you know, way more people to deal with than I do now. You know, I came from a really hardline European style environment. I mean, that's where I cut my teeth, is under, you know, French chefs that were quite frankly pretty mean at times, but their kitchens were silent and worked like a well-oiled machine. Their front of the house was impeccable. There was no room for error ever. And quite frankly, it was kind of a shitty environment to work in because even with our dedication to perfection, there is still always something wrong. And the way they addressed there being something wrong was always very personal. It wasn't, hey, do it like this. It was like, hey, you suck. You know, I'm going to fire you. You're a piece of shit. And because of that, you see the turnaround or the turnover in those kitchens was very quick. You know, you know, 6 to 9 months, you were a senior member of that kitchen if you lasted a year. And you can't just burn through staff like that. But there's a part of me, though, that sees some of the issues that I would have with our staff was very, very good. That's not, you know, the best staff really I've ever worked with. But there are some times where I get that tinge of like, well, that's why Chef so-and-so is always such a dick. Because if you're not always on top of somebody, then they're going to slack off. And there is some truth to that, but it's also the nature of the beast with restaurants. Because in restaurants, you can always do something better. And there's always so much work to be done. You could always be doing more. So people can slack off by accident, you know? So I guess what I'm trying to say is it's a double-edged sword. I never liked being a screaming dick chef because it made me feel bad and it wasn't good for morale. And quite frankly, being in Lake Tahoe, I had to find people that were good and then mentor them and train them and teach them. And I couldn't do that fresh every 6 to 9 months. I couldn't just be this ruthless dick and just burn through employees. But I also didn't want to be in that environment or create that environment, because when I was in that environment as a cook coming up, I hated it. And I didn't want to be there. So, I mean, I remember, you know, I'm sure you guys have all worked for asshole chefs.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the whole perception of what I had. It was like the earlier on in my career, I was working for some pretty asshole chefs that throw stuff and shout at you and, you know, make them feel like you know, weren't doing a good job whatsoever. And it was just a miserable environment. But I think maybe just the way I progressed through restaurants, you know, it seems to me in my perception that the culture has changed in terms of more mentoring, rather than just you suck, you know, do it different.
My chef in culinary school is like old time, like French. I think he was French, but old French style, like chef. Like he really, really knew his shit, but he was literally the most angry person I've ever met in my entire life.
Yeah.
Like after a cleanup, someone would have accidentally left a water glass out and he would just like grab it white knuckled and grit his teeth so hard I thought they were going to crack over a water glass.
There is something to be said, though. There are certain issues that you deal with as a chef that are ongoing. And when you're a chef long enough, when that small little issue comes up, you just lose your shit. Because it's not the first time. It's not the second time. It's like the 100th time over the last decade that you had to deal with that exact same fucking issue.
Bear claw!
Right? And you just, it's hard to not lose it. And again, to be quite honest with you, that's why I say when chefs scream and yell, it's because they're not in control. And that's a good example of it. These little tiny issues that seem small to people, when I had to deal with them time and time and time and time and time again, constantly, and you get a new employee and now they're making that same mistake, even though you've trained them not to make it, you got to repeat it time and time and time and time again, you lose patience. And you start to get this almost helpless feeling where it's like, well, I'm a chef, so this is an issue that, quite frankly, I will always have to deal with. And you try and get zen about it and you say, you know, woosah, I'm just going to, you know, this is part of the job. This will never change. I've dealt with it before. I'll deal with it again and I'll always deal with it. But then sometimes you just snap, you know, you snap.
Yeah, I've done it plenty of times.
Because you're just sick. Because your day, you as a chef, you are time poor. You never have enough time for your prep. You never have enough time to get a dish out. You're always working against the clock. You are constantly time poor. So these little tiny things that steal your time throughout the day that you have to deal with, that shouldn't have to be dealt with because they should be common sense, they drive you mad. And that's why you see chefs acting like lunatics, because quite frankly, they have a momentary lapse into insanity. And there's no other way to explain it.
Well, you know me. I'm Mr. Coolhead.
Yeah.
Something gets under my bonnet. You know, it's mostly like something that's happened 15 times.
Yep.
Into your bonnet. And
into my head. You know what I mean. Bee in my bonnet. You ever heard that?
Nope.
Okay. Anyway. So something that's happened 20 times, and then, you know, I go from being Mr. Coolhead to not being Mr. Coolhead
at all.
Angry
Ben is kind of funny.
You guys all laugh at me.
Ben's cute when he's mad.
Well, you say that because you have a relationship with him, but you know, it's it all. I've always found that it throws people off when the cool headed guy gets pissed. Then they're always like, "Oh shit!" and they pay attention. You know, because the exact opposite of that is just being desensitized to all the screaming and yelling. You know, I worked for an awesome chef who was just known for yelling. And like some days he'd walk in the kitchen, he hadn't been there for 5 minutes, and we were just, everything was on hit. It was the same menu that we've been doing for the last 3 months. It was perfect, right? And he would just start screaming and wouldn't stop for an hour, 2 hours, just because that day was his screaming day. And because of that, when he got mad at us, no one gave a shit anymore. Like, ah, we're still here working our 14-hour shift. We're still going to put out the same menu. And when you get reviewed in 6 months, they're still going to give you the same awesome fucking review. And you're still going to be this amazing chef who's a dick to your employees. Yeah. You know? So we would just... So what happened is if he actually yelled at us about anything important, it would be the exact same thing as him yelling about something that was unimportant. You know? So we got completely desensitized to it.
When I was in charge of a kitchen, my nickname was Mighty Mouse because I was the littlest person by far, and I was constantly yelling at people and breaking their spirits.
I can't imagine Alex yelling at people.
I would get so angry.
Well, because you lose control, yeah? You feel like you've lost control of the situation.
We would serve like 300 to 400 people with 2 to 4 cooks, most of which were almost never even remotely qualified. And I just yelling at them was a way to keep the pace moving because the ticket printer's like for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. And I just yell at people. I made one kid walk out because I told him
Alex, that's horrible. I cannot condone that whatsoever.
No.
It is funny.
It is not funny. And now I'm going to get angry emails because of you, because of what an asshole you are.
It was the heat of the moment.
The heat of the moment.
God. No, that's going to be stuck in my head now.
I can't imagine Alex yelling.
I can.
Really? Have you ever seen it here? I've never seen it.
Well, he's... Yeah, I mean, he doesn't really need to yell here, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. We have stuff very organized here.
Well, and also, too, I mean, I was always kind of, even though I didn't like it, I always played the role of, you know, the daddy who you go tell. You know, so I would always encourage employees to work out issues between them. But, you know, when things weren't going well, you know, I would usually step in, and that would end it. Because for me, I think the best way to send a message is just to give somebody their last paycheck. Just be like, here you go.
Have a good day.
Yep.
We warned you about this.
Paid in full. I'm not going to repeat myself again. Here you go. Bye. And I think there's a certain amount of incompetence that you come across in this industry that because people come from such, I mean, a lot of people go through the school of hard knocks. And some people go through the school of, you know, bad habits. Some people go through the school of hacks. So they've been working for a decade in a kitchen, and they show, it's like, bro, you got like 10 years experience. Like, how are you so shitty? You can hardly even hold a knife, you know? And it's because, well, there's no structure, you know? So you're not going to come out of medical school not knowing how to take someone's blood pressure. You know, I mean, there's certain amounts of like, of structure in place for that. And all these chefs who run kitchens that just have, you know, horrible knife skills, who serve dried pieces of chicken constantly. So I think dealing with that incompetence.
One of my favorite ways one of my fry cooks down was, it puts the chicken in the basket or else it gets the hose again.
I'm trying.
It puts the chicken in the basket or else it gets the hose again.
I'm trying.
Put the chicken in the goddamn basket. That would make everyone but that person laugh their asses off.
So that was the whole question right there, just the European versus U.S. kitchens.
No, so then she goes on, right? So she's so she says, here in Germany, local restaurants have a great model that I hope to leverage in a fitting way in the future in organic gourmet business, where the kitchen opens at 10, lunch is served from 11 to 2 approximately. From 2 to 6, the kitchen is mainly closed, but the restaurant stays open for snacks, coffee, desserts such as cakes and ice cream. The chefs return at 6 and serve dinner from approximately 7 to 10 p.m. when the kitchen closes again. Most local chefs have been working in the same restaurant long term. They seem pretty happy and manage their personal lives with grace because they actually have time for it. There is a true balance between work and life, and it's because of great food and high-class service that the customer keeps coming back at the right time. Question, have you seen this model operate successfully in the U.S.? How do you think it would work in any mid-sized restaurant?
Actually, I saw this just this last weekend. There's one restaurant in Midtown Reno I really like. Actually, the chef's doing a great job. He's done worked at other restaurants in the area. But I show up there for lunch about 3 o'clock, and they're closed. They're open from 11 to 2, and then from 6 to 11. And they're... I thought about, like, you see that with Japanese restaurants a lot. I noticed, like, Japanese restaurants, sushi restaurants, they'll close for, you know, mid-afternoon. But this is the first time we've seen, like, a Western-style restaurant do that. And we're like, yeah, okay. And they're putting out really, really good food, so.
But it's, I mean, it almost sounds like they're working split shifts.
Or I don't think the chef back there is getting a break, even though they're closed.
No.
I think you're – so, again, time – you know, being time poor is the biggest issue. So you say that they open at 10. They serve dinner service from 7 to 10 at night, right? And so, I mean, after cleanup and stuff, even if they're quick, they're not getting out till 11 p.m. So that's still a 13-hour day unless they're going home for 3 hours, which because of how spread out the U.S. is, just – in by nature, there's not a whole lot of people who go home and hang out their house for 3 hours and want to come back to work. You know, so you're still dedicating a 13-hour day to the restaurant. And I guess the real question that she's asking is there a way to be a chef owner of a restaurant without being a dick workaholic?
And still have a life.
And still have a life.
No.
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 Not even close.
Yeah,
To answer somewhat of your question, I do like the model of a restaurant that opens strictly for lunch, has a 3-4 hour break, then opens strictly for dinner. I think that's good in terms of labor, in terms of workflow, you know, but again, the chef is not getting a break. You know, I've worked at restaurants where you serve lunch and then you have kind of this mid bar menu in between.
That's always awful.
And it's horrible because you're prepping hard for dinner. You know, we're prepping for 300-400 people. You know, and you're still trying to put out pizzas and appetizers and stuff like that, and it just really threw a wrench into things. So I like the model of the lunch-dinner thing, but no questions asked. You know, chef has no life. Chef is not getting a break.
Yeah, especially at this place I was just talking about, because they have an open kitchen, and they've got the chef, a line cook, and a prep cook slash dishwasher.
What's the name of the place?
Centro.
Centro, cool. So Alex likes it, so if you're in the Reno area, go check out Centro.
Yeah, Alex got a good taste in restaurants.
Yeah, they're like American tapas style joint, small plates. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, and for me too, the higher end your restaurant is, the less likely it is for you to have a work-life balance. Because so the easiest way to have a work-life balance is to have a 7-day-a-week operation that's busy. And that's casual, because what that allows you to do is allows you to stagger staff. And especially if you're doing like a breakfast, lunch, dinner sort of operation, then you have a morning crew and a night crew. But there is always going to be this whole issue with A team, B team, right? And in fine dining, A team, B team does not work because the stakes are too high. You have that consistency, which is paramount. When people come in to a fine dining restaurant and they're spending $100, $150, $200 a head for dinner, everything has to be flawless. They are looking for reasons to not like you and to not like your food. So if you set a standard and B team misses that standard by just a few percentage points, people are going to be pissed. And that's why at Stella, I made the decision when we were a full-fledged restaurant. We were only open for dinner service, and we were only open 5 nights a week. And we had A-team all the time. Every single day we were open, we, you know,
I couldn't have trusted my station with anyone.
No.
No, exactly.
It was all up here.
Yep, exactly. Because you get used to, I mean, there's so much finesse in the dishes and the prep and being prepared and all that stuff. There's just no other way to do it. And for us, there would be days where we would show up at 10 a.m. and our doors didn't open until 5:30 at night, because that's how prep heavy our menu is, because that's what it takes to pull off a high-end menu. But if you have a restaurant that's more casual, that's cafe style, that's serving things that aren't so prep heavy and are easier to execute and easier to train people on, then through setting up standard operating procedures, which is a whole nother art form in itself. You know, look at a guy like Marco from our boot camp. You know, I mean, that guy had that down to a T. I mean, he would have for his cafe, he had pictures of the sandwiches and each step of that sandwich hanging above the cold stations. So all the people had to do was look up and make the sandwich step by step. He had all the ingredients for each sandwich pre-measured out and weighed. So there's no waste or so that takes a certain amount of work in and of itself. But what that allows you to do as the chef owner is you have these teams that rotate through your kitchens. You have a morning crew, you have a night crew, and you're able to stagger people. And by running a 7-day operation that has multiple services, you can have separate crews and have a little more of a work-life balance where people are working, you know, 8-hour days, which is when you start getting into fine dining, an 8-hour day is laughable. Like if I worked an 8-hour day in a fine dining kitchen, I wouldn't know what to do with myself. I would feel like,
yeah,
you know what I mean? I just,
8-hour day is like a vacation.
Okay, I'm going to go home and eat lunch, and then I'm going to be back. And they're like, no, you're done for the day. What the hell you mean I'm done for the day? I've been here for 8 hours. No, you're done. Go home. I don't know what to do with myself.
Yeah.
So when do we take our lunch break? Do we get my 15 minute after 3 hours?
Yeah, so I think that's it. I mean,
that was the long answer to the short question.
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of working parts, though.
There's a lot, yeah. Definitely.
You know what I mean? Like, it's something that needs to be fleshed out. It's something that I've been struggling with for quite some time, because you also need to think like the mindset of people who get into cooking for a living. Like, they love putting out a good product. And so there's almost like an obsessiveness that comes with it. So figuring out a way to strike that work-life balance without becoming a total maniac is really difficult. Like, it's not easy to do. And one of the major reasons why we transitioned into the Stella culinary model is, number one, I love doing these podcasts, and I love doing the R&D with Ben and Alex. But we were just, all of us were burnt to a crisp. You know, the amount of sacrifice that we would have to make to get through, you know, just the summer season.
Yeah, or like when
was insane.
Before that, like, when's the last time you had Christmas or Thanksgiving with your family? Like,
never.
Exactly.
When I was like 16 years old.
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, at this level, we do it because of passion. But at some point, you kind of go, look, you know, I have a kid, I got a wife, I got a family. Like, you know, find some sort of balance in there.
And I feel more effective now, too, that I've found that work-life balance. Like,
oh, me too.
I feel well-rested. I feel happier. I feel like my production at work has been better, whether I'm working with online content or I'm testing recipes. I'm just more focused because I'm happier. Like, I've forced myself to shut off. You know, I've started doing martial arts again, which is, you know, working meditation for me. You know, so I get some exercise, which is nice, you know, a few days a week, which is really important, which I would never get. And I started reading science fiction because I used to hate science fiction in the past, but I needed something that was so detached from reality that I could read at night to help put my brain to sleep. And it's important to give yourself those mental and physical breaks from the kitchen. But when you're doing a high-end restaurant and you're here every single day, it's really hard to figure out how to do that. You know, I got...
Go home, drink yourself to sleep.
Yeah,
that's what I would do.
Pretty much.
What a lot of people do, man.
I know. And that's why you get a lot of alcoholics in this industry.
And it's not sustainable.
No, it's just a temporary, basically happiness to get through the next day.
Yeah. And the next day you're hammering a bunch of coffee and some taquitos from 7-Eleven and Red Bulls and Gatorade to try and rehydrate yourself and wake yourself up from the ass kicking that you got the night before. You know, and then you just do the whole, and it turns into a really vicious cycle. And I don't know what the right answer is, because for fine dining specifically, I've never met a fine dining chef who wasn't just an absolute maniac who didn't sacrifice everything in his or her life.
Most aren't married or you know, multiple divorces or, you know, and that kind of thing.
And the married ones don't have kids.
Yeah.
And the married ones who have kids, they are the 1% of the 1%. And maybe they put on a happy facade, but you don't know what's going on in their home.
Yeah.
You know, you don't know what happens when their daughter reaches 15 years old and hates the dad for never being there.
Yeah.
You know, so it's all stuff that you have to... that you have to deal with. And I think it, you know, when you're looking at the top restaurants in the world, it is almost like being on the top athletic team in the world. You know, there's a certain level of, it's like, okay, you want to be the baddest ass dude in the world? Like, okay, you're going to have to sacrifice everything. And being the best in the world is going to have to be enough to fulfill your life on every single level, because that's the only thing in your life that you will have time for. And as a very competitive person, you know, like, and I think most people who are chefs are competitive by nature. And I think it's, you get drawn into that to a certain degree and to a certain level. And, you know, there is a time where I had the desire to be the best chef in the world. You know, I mean, you start thinking, like, where's this headed? Like, where's this going to lead me? But then you look at the guys who are doing it, the best guys in the world. Rene Redzepi, you know, of Noma. Fran Adria of El Bulli when it was still open. And they're just nuts. That's all they do. And Fran Adria was this total mad scientist, workaholic, with this crazy team behind him that everyone sacrificed everything. Best restaurant in the world, they're losing $500,000 a year. That's fucking fine dining right there. That's fine dining.
To a T right there.
You know, best restaurant in the world, sold out a year in advance, and somehow you manage to lose $500,000 a year with no life. And then, because with the limited time you have to go on speaking tours and write cookbooks, because that's how you make your real money. You know, it's crazy to me. It's such a broken model. And, I mean, someone way smarter than me is going to have to figure out the answer to how do you make fine dining truly sustainable. Because I've never seen it done. I've seen people fake it really well. I've never seen it done, though.
I think it's labor and food costs are out of control.
You think? Yeah. And there's definitely high-end fine dining restaurants out there that are making money. But every single person who works for them is sacrificing. From the chef owner all the way down. Everybody sacrifices. All the way to the dishwashers,
definitely.
Yep. So, you know, Sandra, the model that you're observing in Europe might be a good model. And especially if you're going to go fast casual. If you're going to go fine dining, really, I mean, all bets are off. There's no way getting around it. You can definitely be a nice person to work for. You could be motivating and be a good mentor in a fine dining environment. There's lots of chefs who do that. But having a work-life balance in a fine dining environment, I think you're going to have some struggles with that.
Liz, you have a good shoe, chef.
Yeah. All right. And that's it for this episode of Ask Chef Jacob. Thanks so much for tuning in and listening. You can find this episode's show notes by going to stellaculinary.com/ACJ16. And it'll drop you right into this episode's show notes where you can pick up on the discussion that we were having. Sign up for a free email newsletter by going to stellaculinary.com. check out the forum, all that good stuff. Tons of videos on YouTube. And we'll see you guys in our next episode.
Check you later.
That light bulb's out. These people.